Hello, listeners, and welcome back to In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. As always, I'm your host, Paul Townsend, and I want to start off by saying a quick thank you to everyone who reached out about the last episode we did on Stephen Donziger. I was a bit concerned at first that people would not like covering cases in multiple installments, but the feedback has really been overwhelmingly positive, so I appreciate all of you who took the time to write me and tell me how much you enjoyed it. Thank you. I'm also grateful for the people who have reached out to encourage me to put out episodes every week instead of every other week. I love that you want more. Unfortunately, I simply don't have the time to do the research and recording and juggle a full-time job as a lawyer and still see my family from time to time. So for the moment, every other week, it's going to have to be. But please keep up the encouragement because it really does keep me motivated to keep creating new episodes. In this installment, we're going to look at a case you probably saw in the news or heard about through friends, but you probably wouldn't recognize the actual name of the defendant if you heard it in passing. And the reason for this is that this person did everything under a pseudonym. He called himself Dread Pirate Roberts, a character from The Princess Bride. And what he did to get himself in hot water with the federal government was that he created an anonymous marketplace called the Silk Road on a part of the internet called the Dark Web, where vendors and customers could buy and sell all manner of illegal contraband and substances using Bitcoin, a cryptocurrency. And everything through Bitcoin was able to be done anonymously. This is a case I've been wanting to do ever since I started this podcast, but it's especially pertinent now as industry titans like Elon Musk have started using their power and influence to push for cryptocurrency like Dogecoin as a substitute for fiat or paper currency. We're going to take a look at what cryptocurrency is, how the dark web operates, and how bad or illegal acts of investigators may impact an investigation, as well as examine what a federal judge is able to consider during sentencing. This is the United States of America versus Ross Ulbricht. The story of Ross Ulbricht is a cautionary tale about how an idea can start as something positive, but become warped into something dark and dangerous. Ulbricht didn't set out to be some black hat hacker who wanted to burn the world economy to the ground. Quite the opposite. A quick look at his history and what we know about his personal philosophy will provide some key insights into how he decided to create and manage the Silk Road. Ross Ulbricht was born on March 27th, 1984. His birthday is coming up. He grew up in Austin, Texas, and had a relatively traditional childhood. Like many boys growing up in Texas in the 80s and 90s, Ulbricht was a Boy Scout, eventually reaching the rank of Eagle Scout. He went to public high school, and then the University of Texas at Dallas on a full academic scholarship. He graduated college in 2006 with a physics degree. After the University of Texas, he attended Penn State University, where he got a master's degree in material science, engineering, and crystallography, which is the study of the structures and properties of crystals. While he was in college, Ulbricht became interested in libertarian economic theory. This intensified in graduate school. He ardently supported Ron Paul and joined scholastic debates to voice his economic views. Ulbricht was exceptionally bright and a strong debater, and his successes reinforced his belief that his views on markets and trade were superior to other economic models. In 2009, when he graduated from Penn State, he returned to Austin. But he really didn't know what exactly he was going to do with his master's degree. He dabbled in day trading, but he lost too much money, so he quit. He then formed a video game company and created a massive multiplayer online role-playing game, which he claimed was intended to create an economic simulation to give people a firsthand experience of what it would be like to live in a world without the systemic use of governmental force on trade. Essentially, he created an online environment to live out a libertarian market theory utopia. The company failed. Hard to imagine why kids aged 10 to 25, the target demographic for these types of games, wouldn't want to participate in a game geared towards deregulated economic transactions, but such is the way of it. Next, also in 2009, Ulbricht partnered with his friend Donnie Palmertree to build an online used bookseller called Good Wagon Books. The company was profitable, but barely. Ulbricht was unhappy and felt unfulfilled there, and ultimately Palmertree bought him out at the end of 2010. It's around this time that Ulbricht had come up with the idea to create a website where people could buy or sell anything anonymously. There would be no trail to lead anyone to either end of the transaction, and thus no ability to enforce any regulations or taxes on the sales. Initially, Ulbricht wanted to call the website Underground Brokers, but ultimately he settled on Silk Road. Ulbricht was obsessed with the libertarian idea of completely free trade, where no government agency could tax or restrict purchasing. There would be no paternalism. But he quickly ran into a problem. He didn't have a business model or strategy to attract vendors or customers. Essentially, he could create the marketplace, but he didn't have anything to sell. So Ulbricht asked himself what he could sell that he thought people would buy. He reasoned that he would probably have to market something illegal, otherwise people would simply buy the item through legitimate channels rather than through the Silk Road, which was going to require a lot more effort on the end of the users. He settled on psychedelic mushrooms. The plan was to sell shrooms cheap as a way to generate interest in his marketplace. He rented an out-of-the-way cabin and started growing shrooms. As time progressed, Ulbricht consulted computer programmers and hackers alike, sending them his code, asking them to identify weaknesses. He learned how to host a website and maintain his own servers. He started selling his shrooms on the Silk Road, and people quickly started buying them using Bitcoin. I'm going to give you a quick and dirty explanation of cryptocurrency, like Bitcoin, Dogecoin, Ethereum, etc., through what Ulbricht's criminal complaint said. This isn't perfect, but it's a concise description, which I think is useful here. Bitcoins are an anonymous, decentralized form of electronic currency, existing entirely on the internet and not in physical form. They're generated and controlled automatically through computer software, operating on a peer-to-peer network. Bitcoin transactions are processed collectively by the computers composing the network. In order to acquire Bitcoins in the first instance, a user must typically purchase them from a Bitcoin exchange at a fluctuating exchange rate. Once the Bitcoins are acquired, they are kept in a wallet associated with a Bitcoin address, designated by a complex string of letters and numbers. The address is analogous to a bank account number, and the wallet is analogous to a safe. Once a wallet is funded, the user can use the Bitcoins to conduct financial transactions from his or her Bitcoin address to the address of another Bitcoin holder. All Bitcoin transactions are recorded on a public ledger known as the blockchain, which exists in order to prevent a user from spending the same Bitcoins more than once. However, the blockchain only reflects the movement of funds between anonymous Bitcoin addresses and therefore cannot by itself be used to determine the identities of the persons involved in the transactions. So, back to Silk Road. Bit by bit, vendors started signing up. To really understand how the Silk Road was able to operate as a completely online open-air marketplace where a person could buy drugs, guns, credit card numbers, subscription account information, personal data, etc., without government agencies immediately shutting it down, you have to understand how the dark web operates. Chances are, at some point, you have heard the term dark web and have been given bits and pieces of what it is and how it operates, but unless you're a programmer or a hacker, you probably don't have a full understanding of just what it is. So here goes. The first thing that you need to know is that there is a deep web and that there is a dark web. They are not the same, so some people incorrectly use them in the same way. The deep web is the part of the internet that is not indexed by your typical search engines like Google, Bing, Yahoo. You get the picture. This includes anything behind a paywall, which requires a login credential. Things like medical records, access to media sites you need to pay for, things like that you cannot simply access through a series of keystrokes and clicks. It is still generally accessible through normal internet browsers if you have the right abilities and credentials to gain entry. The dark web, on the other hand, is a small subsection of the deep web, but it goes much farther. It requires a specific browser called a Tor to access. The Tor routes your web page request through a series of proxy servers operated by different people all over the globe. The result is that your IP address becomes untraceable. Instead of using a .com or .org at the end of a web page, the dark web uses a .onion domain suffix. Also, the web addresses are not descriptive, like on the normal ClearNet, which is how dark web users refer to the normal unencrypted internet of everyday use. Instead of typing netflix.com to go to the Netflix sites, dark web sites use an unintelligible series of letters and numbers, so one vendor's web page may be jw76vth2ll.onion, and that might route you to Anna Friedberg's Crystal Meth Emporium. There are some dark web search engines, but the websites are so transitory that dedicated search sites are pretty useless. Generally, you're going to need to know exactly where you want to go and what you're looking for if you want to actually get there. There's a lot more to the dark web than this, but for our purposes, what you need to know is that it allows users to go through different marketplaces anonymously and allows for transactions to be made through cryptocurrency, which allows both the buyer and the seller to remain anonymous from each other. All the seller gets is an address where the item is to be sent, and most darknet users keep PO boxes for this purpose so that they can maintain total anonymity. At the height of Silk Road, Bitcoin was king of the cryptocurrency universe, so transactions on Silk Road were conducted through Bitcoin. As noted at the top of the show, Ulbricht used an alias in all of his business dealings related to the Silk Road, Dread Pirate Roberts. There was much debate as to whether he was the only person to use that moniker, but at this point, it's pretty well established that Ulbricht was at least one of the individuals, perhaps the first, who used it. The Silk Road went live in February 2011. Ulbricht had a few key people working with him in 2011 and 2012 to maintain security, monitor message boards, keep the servers running, but the idea and the policy came directly from Ulbricht himself. He envisioned the Silk Road to be an underground libertarian market paradise. No government interference, no taxes, no regulations, no paternalism. A person could buy whatever they could afford or sell whatever they had. Now, of course, there would be a small transaction fee going to Ulbricht as the administrator of the market, but that's the cost of doing business in a free market, and people were free to exit the market if they didn't want to pay. Here is the problem with this idea. If you advertise that people can buy or sell whatever they want, on the whole, people care less about saving the 8% on sales tax and more about buying contraband without the inherent risk of having to meet a guy in a back alley in the middle of the night. Even Ulbricht himself knew that if he wanted to generate interest, he was going to have to sell drugs to get the market going off the ground. Immediately, the Silk Road became the dark web go-to place for anything illegal a person wanted to buy or sell. Hackers could sell access to people's personal information with impunity. You could buy guns. You could buy drugs. There is even a section of the marketplace where you could hire contract killers. In June 2011, the media website Gawker published a long descriptive article about the site, and its traffic skyrocketed. But now the Silk Road had the attention of the federal government, and directives were given to the DEA and the Department of Justice to find a way to shut it down. But to shut it down, they would need to find Dread Pirate Roberts. And how do you find someone who has no web footprints and only goes by an alias? For a long time, there was simply no answer to that question. The site remained up, and federal agents were largely powerless to do anything. Enter Gary Alford. Alford was an IRS criminal investigator who is extremely interested in Silk Road. While off duty for nearly 2 years, he conducted his own research before he finally managed to get himself assigned to the Silk Road Task Force in February 2013. Alford ultimately noticed in May 2013 that when Silk Road was first launched, announcements about the site were made by someone with the username Altoid, like the Mint. Altoid was trying to attract business, referring to Silk Road as, quote, kind of like an anonymous Amazon, end quote. Alford assumed that whoever Altoid was, he had intimate knowledge of the site, being involved at such an early stage. And if he wasn't the creator himself, it was someone who at least knew the creator. He scoured the web for other information linked to Altoid. And in June 2013, he had a breakthrough. Sometime before the launch of Silk Road, Altoid had asked for programming help, and he had given his email address, rossulbricht@gmail.com. The actual post advertising help had been deleted, but another user had responded, and the original message had been saved in the chain. Alford ran a search for Ross Ulbricht and found information on a young man in Texas whose online persona was full of the same libertarian ideology that Dread Pirate Roberts was frequently posting on the Silk Road message boards. Alford rushed the information to the heads of the Silk Road Task Force. He expected agents to be immediately dispatched to Texas to find Ulbricht and question him. Amazingly, he was met with disinterest. No agents were sent to Texas. No subpoenas were sought. No surveillance was ordered. But Alford was undeterred. He continued his own personal investigation into Ulbricht. Eventually, Alford bypassed his own supervisor and went right to Saren Turner, the Manhattan federal prosecutor who was in charge of the whole investigation. But Turner also brushed him off. At this point, Alford became a little distressed. He kept his own tabs on Ulbricht, who had since moved to San Francisco, but he was frustrated that he couldn't find anyone to listen to him and take him seriously. In early September 2013, Alford asked a colleague to run a routine background check on Ulbricht again. But this time, he hit gold. The check revealed that in July 2013, Homeland Security had seized a package with 9 fake IDs at the Canadian border. The package was addressed to Ulbricht. The agents went to Ulbricht's San Francisco residence, having no idea of any possible connection to Silk Road. During their questioning, Ulbricht casually mentioned that, quote, hypothetically, anyone could go on a site called Silk Road and buy fake IDs, end quote. Alford called Saren Turner again. This time, he got the response he wanted. Within minutes, the federal prosecutor told him that a quick search of the San Francisco address was a mere 100 feet or so from a cafe where Dread Pirate Roberts had been known to log into the Silk Road. Now, agents were dispatched, and Ulbricht was arrested at a public library in San Francisco on October 2, 2013. For his part, Alford was recognized with a plaque engraved with a Sherlock Holmes quote, "The world is full of obvious things which nobody, by chance, ever observes." The prosecution took place in Manhattan, in the Southern District of New York Federal Court. Undercover agents had been making purchases from Silk Road in the Southern District of New York, so since criminal activity had taken place there, they had jurisdiction over the matter. The judge assigned was the Honorable Catherine B. Forrest. Judge Forrest was appointed by President Obama to become a district court judge in May of 2011, meaning she had about 2.5 years on the job when she was assigned this massively high-profile case. Ulbricht was charged with conspiracy to traffic narcotics, money laundering, computer hacking, and the complaint also alleged that Ulbricht solicited another user to execute murder for hire of several individuals who threatened to release the identities of thousands of users of the site. His attorney was Joshua Dreitel, who graduated magna cum laude from Columbia and went on to Harvard Law School. He was no slouch. There was one significant motion filed by Dreitel prior to the trial starting. In all the filings related to the case, the government captioned the case United States of America v. Ross William Ulbricht, a.k.a. Dread Pirate Roberts, a.k.a. DPR, a.k.a. Silk Road. Dreitel argued that the whole point of the trial was that the government had to prove that Obrecht was, in fact, Dread Pirate Roberts. By introducing the case to the jury in the way the government was intending to do, Dreitel claimed the jury was basically being told from the beginning that he's guilty. Judge Forrest declined to remove the aliases from the official case record. So let's get into the trial. It began on January 13th, 2015, a little more than a year after Olbrich's arrest. The government's argument, presented by Saren Turner, was that Olbrich was Altoid. Altoid had offered rossolbrecht at gmail.com as his contact info. Altoid had then also posted about Silk Road. Olbrich brought up Silk Road to agents completely unprompted. When Olbrich was arrested, there was evidence tying him to Silk Road on the laptop in his possession. Further, the government claimed that they had located Silk Road's dedicated servers in Iceland through a leaked IP address, and they said that the servers were also tied to Olbrich. Dreitel's defense was relatively simple. He claimed that Olbrich was simply not the Dread Pirate Roberts as depicted by the government. He conceded that Olbrich did create the Silk Road as a libertarian economic experiment, but that immediately after he created it, he turned it over to some other individual, the real Dread Pirate Roberts, who is still out there. He named that individual as Mark Karpeles, the CEO of Mt. Gox, which at the time was the biggest Bitcoin exchange in the world. This was bolstered by an interview conducted with the real Dread Pirate Roberts in 2013, where he told Forbes journalist Andy Greenberg that he had actually inherited the site from a predecessor. Now, the government had seized somewhere between $18 to $20 million worth of Bitcoin from Olbrich's hard drive. Dreitel had to explain that somehow, so he claimed that Olbrich was an avid Bitcoin speculator, but that having that significant amount of Bitcoin wasn't evidence that he actually was collecting Silk Road transaction fees. The first few days of the trial actually went fairly well for Olbrich. The prosecution called Special Agent Jared Derugian, who admitted under cross-examination that even just before they arrested Olbrich, he believed that Karpeles was actually the real Dread Pirate Roberts. Now, one big issue that came up during the trial was that the servers were located on Iceland. The defense accused the government of employing illegal search techniques to find a server with formidable anonymity software. Dreitel claimed the FBI must have been using an NSA Tor cracking technique, which was not permitted without a warrant. No warrant was ever issued. The result would be a Fourth Amendment violation. The government's answer was that they simply tweaked the Silk Road login page and then it leaked its location on its own. And I think we can all agree that that's a fairly far-fetched story by the government. Judge Forrest listened intently, considered both arguments, and ruled that the server information was admissible. Her reasoning was that Olbrich was denying being Dread Pirate Roberts. Because of that, he did not have standing to challenge the search. Since he was denying that the servers belonged to him, he did not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in them. And thus, he could not contest a search conducted of them, even one done without a warrant. At the beginning of the last week of the trial, things had turned and were not looking so good for Ross Olbrich. The prosecution had produced chat logs, forum posts, private messages, emails, even Olbrich's personal diary came into evidence, linking him to Silk Road. Dreitel had also lost the ability to cross-examine the prosecution's computer expert on certain topics which were deemed outside of his expertise. He then could not call his own expert because he had not met the disclosure notice requirements at the time. Then Judge Forrest instructed the jury to disregard what Agent Derugian had said about Mark Karpeles, saying that what the agent had previously suspected about others is not evidence and could not be considered. Now, the justification for this ruling came from a Second Circuit case, United States v. Johnson. But the key in that case was that it was the prosecutor who was precluded from asking who the policeman suspected. And one can easily see why a prosecutor should not be allowed to put a law enforcement agent on the stand and ask him or her to finger a suspect. But it's an entirely different situation when the defense is seeking to do it. And nevertheless, Judge Forrest ruled that none of it was suitable consideration for the jury. The prosecution also made some odd choices in who they called as witnesses. Now, the lead agent on the case, Christopher Tarbell, led the arrest team and signed the declaration as to how the Icelandic servers were found. He was not called as a witness and did not testify. Throughout the trial, the evidence pretty clearly established that Dread Pirate Roberts was unquestionably the leader and overseer of the Silk Road. But ties between Ulbricht and DPR were a bit tenuous. There was evidence that Ulbricht was involved in the creation of Silk Road, but nothing concrete showing him to be an ongoing version of Dread Pirate Roberts himself. It was still conceivable that he had launched the site and turned it over, as Dreitel stated in his opening address. Until the testimony of Richard Bates. Bates had been friends with Ulbricht in college. When Ulbricht went to Penn State Graduate School, Bates went to work at PayPal. They met up again in 2010, back in Austin. Bates testified that Ulbricht was asking him a lot of questions about programming for a secret project he was working on. Bates had become suspicious that it was Tor-related and told Ulbricht that he either had to tell Bates exactly what he was doing or he could no longer rely on Bates for help. Bates then testified that was when Ulbricht told him that he was creating the Silk Road and showed him the Green Camel logo, which appeared on the website. Bates' testimony became crucial for the prosecution because Bates swore under oath that by June 2011, when federal agencies were picking up on Silk Road's existence and investigating ways to shut it down because of all the illegal contraband it was dealing, Ulbricht was still in charge. That completely contradicted the entire defense narrative. For his testimony, Bates received a non-prosecution agreement for his role in setting up the site, the Bitcoin exchange, and all of the drugs he bought off it. Now, all of this courtroom drama was crammed into roughly 4 weeks. On February 4th, 2015, a jury convicted Ulbricht of all seven charges he was facing. The case was scheduled for sentencing on May 29th, 2015. But between the conviction and sentencing, something rather odd happened. In March 2015, a criminal complaint issued in the Northern District of California led to the arrest of two agents who had worked undercover on the Silk Road investigation, Mark Force and Sean Bridges. The complaint alleged that these two men had kept funds that Ulbricht had transferred to them in exchange for information about the investigation. A third agent was then arrested for tampering with Silk Road chat logs showing that he was offering Dread Pirate Roberts information for money. While the government had known about these three individuals prior to Ulbricht's trial, the existence of these cases was not disclosed to Dreitel's team until after the conviction was handed down. Dreitel argued in his appeal that both their existence and their actions were directly relevant to the trial, and that Ulbricht was deprived of due process by not being told about them and not being able to use them as part of his defense. This brings up an interesting discussion about the effects of bad acts by law enforcement occurring during a criminal investigation. Depending on what the agents actually do, it can either simply be embarrassing for the agency, or it can actually lead to charges being dismissed against the defendant and filed against the agent. This happens most frequently with undercover agents. Now, there's a good deal of leeway given to agents with regard to actions which they may be required to do to maintain an undercover identity, but there are limits. For example, they cannot commit murder, and they cannot keep money obtained illegally. If an undercover agent commits a serious crime, it destroys their credibility. And frequently, it's their testimony which is absolutely necessary to convict people because it's their firsthand knowledge of the criminal conduct which builds the case. Without that, the case can be lost. In this particular case, however, when the Second Circuit was informed of what these agents had done, their response was essentially, well, so what as it relates to Ulbricht? They've been charged. Seems like that's that. In essence, the appellate judges saw nothing about this direct situation which called into question any of the evidence which was actually presented at Ulbricht's trial. And if anything, it actually made Ulbricht seem even more guilty. Dreitel had also tried his luck with Judge Forrest, requesting a new trial based on this information. And Judge Forrest promptly denied that and reiterated that the sentencing date would not change. Ulbricht was sentenced to 2 concurrent life sentences, as well as 3 other concurrent sentences. In determining his punishment, Judge Forrest indicated that despite the fact that the government had elected not to charge Ulbricht with paying people to commit 5 murders over Silk Road, that sufficient evidence had been produced at the trial that he had done so. And because of that, Judge Forrest said she was permitted to consider that in fashioning her sentence. After his appeal to the Second Circuit was denied, the Supreme Court declined to take up Ulbricht's case. In summation, I have a lot of respect for Joshua Dreitel. He is a good lawyer who has had a lot of success on a number of very complex cases over the years. His biggest issue here was that Judge Forrest kept shutting the door on his strategy. Normally, I would say that as a defense attorney, you should have known the particular judge's temperament that you're going to be trying a case in front of, but I can't really fault him. Judge Forrest was new to the bench. 2 years is a pretty short amount of time to get a sense of how a judge is going to react in certain situations, especially in a case like this, which is very technical and very nuanced. Still, knowing how much of this case revolved around computers and experts, Dreitel should not have assumed he would be able to question the people's computer science expert on any and every topic he wanted to without having his own expert already lined up and notice of that expert provided. By the time he informed the prosecutor that he was planning to call his own computer guy, it was too late, and Judge Forrest ruled that the statutory period of time that he had to let the government know had already lapsed. I also give Judge Forrest a lot of credit for this case. Her rulings were law-based and fair, and she never missed a beat with the trial despite receiving multiple death threats from hacker groups supporting Ulbricht. This case really exemplifies the vast array of resources that the federal government can put into a big investigation. Nearly every federal law enforcement agency had agents involved in this investigation in some capacity. There were field agents, forensic computer experts, researchers, analysts, undercovers, tech consultants, on and on and on. At the end of the day, the evidence that they compiled was enough to convince 12 people that they had successfully shown that Ross Ulbricht was not only Dread Pirate Roberts, but that he had maintained control of the Silk Road, and that because of his creation and domination of the marketplace, he was individually responsible for everything that took place on it. I would imagine some people get a sense of comfort knowing that the government is willing to expend all this time and resource to root out massive criminal activity. Others, I think, remain skeptical of how awesome power is wielded, wondering if there weren't perhaps some corners that were cut and rules that were bent in order to secure all the evidence in this case. In the end, like so many other cases, the final straw wasn't some obscure chat log or transaction report. It was a person who knew the defendant testifying about his personal interactions. Those are always the most destructive witnesses to a defense case, because it is often so hard to uncover a reason that they would lie or exaggerate. And even in a situation like this, where Bates was given a non-prosecution agreement, essentially immunizing him from any of the things that he did, ultimately, they weren't able to overcome the reliability of what he was saying. So that's the show this time around. I really hope you enjoyed it and learned a little something about a case that has always fascinated me. Thanks, as always, to Dan Townsend, a great audio engineer and an even better brother. And also a special thank you to my Canada, Europe, Asia, and Australia listeners. Most of you, I have no idea how you found the show, but I appreciate you and I am grateful for your continued support. If you have enjoyed the show, please rate and review it on whatever platform you use. That helps other people come across it. If you have any feedback, you can get me on Twitter at InsummationPod or email me at InsummationPodcast@gmail.com. I really do try to respond to all emails I get as quickly as possible. Until next time, I'm Paul Townsend. Thanks again for stopping by, and I hope you'll come back for more.